Thank you, brethren, and it's a joy to be with you and to see your smiling faces. And Sister Virginia's regrets that she was unable to come with us, but she sends her warm, special love to all of you. And also Obie and Janet Albert send their special love. And if you looked at the handout, some of you say, oh, well, I've heard this before. Well, the first part would be a little similar to what I've given recently, but especially the seventh trumpet part I feel is very important and needs re-emphasizing. Then hopefully we'll get into other details that might be similar, but different than what most of you have heard, or all of you have heard. All right, on the handout, we have the first and second page, which deals with the seventh trumpet. A major Bible student publication has come out in print that the seventh trumpet has not yet sounded. And when I first read this, and this isn't recently, it's about 2 years ago, I was very saddened. Because all during Brother Russell's day, and since Brother Russell's day, the seventh trumpet has been the hallmark of the Bible student movement. And now to think that this hallmark is being denied by brethren that have held it up for so many years, it's very sad. So the first two pages are showing that the seventh trumpet has sounded. Actually, you know, you've all heard of the domino effect. You change one point, and then eventually you have to change another point to harmonize that point, and this is what's happening. Basically, brethren don't have an answer to Revelation 11, the sounding of the seventh trumpet, and the reign of Christ begins. No way of really refuting that, so they put the seventh trumpet future. And they use Revelation 10:7 to do that. And in the King James, and on the handout it notes, it quotes Revelation 10:7, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God shall be finished, as he hath declared to his servants the prophets. So, according to Revelation 10:7 in the King James, when the seventh trumpet begins to sound, the mystery of God or the church is completed. But many modern translations translate it like the New American Standard: when he is about to sound, the mystery of God is finished. So they say, see, before the seventh trumpet sounds, the mystery of God is completed, the church is completed, and if the church isn't completed, then the seventh trumpet hasn't begun to sound yet. Well, the first page is an evaluation of the whole Greek structure, not of just the word mellow that is translated began or about in these two translations, but the whole Greek structure of this phrase and the conclusion that this wasn't my construction or deductions on page one. It's a brother who is very studied in Greek, actually studied it in two universities, including Yale, and the bottom where it's blocked out are his conclusions from the Greek. For the reasons above, the following reading appears to be correct. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he should surely sound, the seventh trumpet of the mystery of God is finished. So he feels that the Greek puts an emphasis that when the seventh trumpet shall surely sound, that the mystery of God will be completed. On the back of that sheet, we've just taken all of the occasions from Young's Concordance where the Greek word mellow is used in the King James Bible. And remember, the Greek word mellow is the typical word here, whether it means begin or whether it means about to. In addition to what has been said on the first page, we would just observe with the Greek word mello, it is only translated one time about, and it is translated shall, will, should, a total of 60 times. So obviously, Revelation 10:7 teaches that the seventh trumpet shall, will, should, would sound before the church is completed. So however you would translate it into this majority way of translating it, whenever the seventh trumpet sounds, the church will be completed. Therefore, the church is completed. The church is completed during the sounding of the seventh trumpet and not after the sounding of the seventh trumpet. We don't want to go into detail on this. Just ask you to read your handout at home. We'll just say one further thing on Revelation 11:15-18. And the seventh angel sounded, and this is in our box portion on the second page. And the seventh angel sounded, and there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. The Greek word is kingdom singular. So when Christ returned, the kingdom of this world, which was Satan's by usurpations, became Christ when he returned in 1874. And what is he doing with it? He's judging it and he's destroying it, the kingdom of this world. And then it goes on to say that the nations were angry, thy wrath has come in the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and thou wouldst give a reward unto thy servants and prophets and to the saints, and them that fear thy name, great and small. So you say, well, it's so clear here that the saints are rewarded when the seventh trumpet sounds. But what some brethren will say, but notice that they know. It says servants, prophets, and saints. So the servants and prophets are the Old Testament, so these are Old Testament saints that's mentioned here. But we submit that in the book of Revelation, and we give the citations, Revelation 16:6, Revelation 18:24, and Revelation 10:7, that the terms servants, prophets, and saints are used together and interchangeably, all three referring to the church in the book of Revelation. So one of the things that happens when the seventh trumpet sounds is that the church, that are the servants, prophets, and saints of God, will receive their reward. The church will be completed. And then the great will receive their reward, who we feel will be the ancient worthies. And then the small, the rest of the world of mankind, will be dealt with in their judgment day. Okay, other scriptures are given on here. We just went through this very hastily. But it's a very serious deviation. We feel that it is the most serious deviation from the truth currently, and we ask your prayerful consideration of this. Okay, now we'll go through this handout briefly and then give a overview of the current situation of Israel, and then we'll come back to specific scriptures to go into greater detail on some events that are happening in Israel. Okay, your third page on the handout, our enemies, the Saudis. We've mentioned this several other places. This is the first time I've attached this particular article to the handout, to a handout. Why are the Saudis our enemies? You know, the biggest joke, or one of the biggest jokes of our time, is that Saudi Arabia is a moderate Arab country, and they're the friends of the United States. This writer has it right on the line. The Saudis are enemies. Why? Saudi Arabia is bankrolling Islamic fundamentalism. Islamic fundamentalism is based on Wahhabism. And the development and the history of Wahhabism is given on page 4. And, of course, this article on page 3 deals with the two. Wahhabism was founded by an Arab by the name of Wahhabi. Wahhabi. He lived on the Arabian Peninsula in the late 1700s and early 1800s. He came out with a perversion of Islam, which was called Wahhabism, and he was excommunicated by the Sunnis. The Sunni is the largest major sect in Islam. But Wahhabi's daughter in the 1800s married into the Saud tribe. The Saud tribe on the Arabian Peninsula was a minority power base. Actually, they're a bunch of bandits, highway robbers. But they were a minority power base. And the Saudi tribe converted to Wahhabism in 1924 and 1925. The Saudi tribe rebelled against the leading power in Saudi Arabia, which was the Hussein family that controlled Mecca and Medina. We won't go into some interesting details there. So, but what happened was the Saudi tribe then changed the name of the Arabian Peninsula to Saudi Arabia. And they became the dominant force in Saudi Arabia, the ruling family of Saudi Arabia. And they began exporting Wahhabism, which is Islamic fundamentalism, throughout the Middle East, European mosques. 80% of the mosques in the United States have Islamic clerics that are teaching Wahhabism. What these clerics say to the public in English and what they teach their congregation in Arabic is two completely different things. Now, it's not a coincidence that how many? 15 of the suicide bombers or suicide squad that was involved on September 11th were from where? Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabia today are exporting Islamic fundamentalism. They are paying for the exporting of this propaganda of Islamic fundamentalism throughout the Middle East and the Far East. You know, in the Middle East, the different Arab countries have a very limited public school system. So what the Sauds do, they go into each of these countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and all the others, and they set up their schools, and they get free education. But what do they teach? Islamic fundamentalism. They are the backbone of the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Okay, enough for that. Except one more interesting thing. Page 5. Islam and the possible church-state union. And we'll just quote from the bottom. It's a quote from Charles Malik, who is a Harvard University professor. He is a Christian Arab from Lebanon. He was very prominent in the UN during the 1950s and 60s especially, and he is considered an authority on world affairs. And he says, quote, "The only hope for the Western world lies in an alliance between the Roman Catholic Church, which is the most commonly influential controlling, unifying element in Europe, and the Eastern Orthodox Church. Rome must unite with Eastern Orthodoxy because the Eastern Orthodox Church controls the Western Middle East, parentheses, the east end of the Mediterranean, and if they don't solidify that control, Islam will march across Europe. Islam is political. The only hope of the Western world lies then in a united Europe under the control of the Pope, and then all Protestant Christians around the globe must come into subjection of the Pope so that we will have a unified Christian world." And what is the necessity? That's the end of the quote. What is the necessity of this unified Christian Europe and unified Christian world? To fend off, to defeat the forces of Islam that are determined to march around the world. You know, I get letters from Arabs, because of my work. And there was a college professor from Stanford University in California. He says, in 10 years, we're going to have 6 million converts to Islam in this country. And soon after that, we will take over the country. This is their idea. We might think it's far-fetched. And notice I say, Islam and the possible church-state union. This might or might not take place, but this is a possibility for why or reason for the churches coming to power in the future. All right, our next part of the handout is a my studied thoughts on what takes place from 1967 war to the mediatorial reign. It's for your perusal and your studies, and if you come to similar conclusions or different conclusions, this isn't the final word by any means, but I would enjoy your input on these suggestions here. And at this point, we will just consider very quickly on page 8, with the point of interest, the bottom of page 8, Israel quality of life. This is a word of encouragement to some of the brethren who are considering going on a comfort mission to Israel. The blessing of the Lord, one could get an idea to the contrary watching the current news, but Israelis enjoy some of the highest life expectancies in the world. It goes on to show the life expectancy of the Israeli women and men. And then it says, deaths from trauma, accidents, and violence are still much rarer here in Israel than abroad. If you don't believe that one, walk through the city of Chicago at night or walk through the city of New York at night and you will believe it. Okay, we'll come to some of the other points later on as we go along. Now, by the way, could I have a glass of water if there's not one around? As we said, no, it's the biggest joke is Saudi Arabia being a moderate Arab state. It's neither moderate, thank you, Brother John. It's neither moderate. It's actually the source of Islamic terrorism. What time did we start, John? Okay. And thus it's the enemy of the United States. Until June 1st, the United States had Saudi Arabia on the list of U.S. allies in the war against terrorism. And the reason was that Saudi Arabia says, sure, we're against terrorism. Certainly we're against terrorism. But you know, from the beginning of the invasion of Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia was opposed to the United States invasion of Afghanistan. So finally, just around June 1st, the United States finally took Saudi Arabia off the list of allies that are in the war against terrorism. Now, why is President Bush in favor of and pushing the Saudi peace plan as the basis of starting peace negotiations? And you've probably heard of the Saudi peace plan. The Saudi peace plan, I'll break it down. It's a number of parts. I'll break it down into two general parts. One, if Israel returns to the 67 borders, then all the Arab states, 22 of them, will recognize Israel's right to exist. Gee, thanks. Israel's existed since 1948, and they seem to be doing pretty well on their own. That's another big joke. They will recognize Israel's right to exist. Okay, then the second part of this Saudi plan is that Israel must accept the right of return of the so-called 3 million Palestinian refugees. to Israel proper. Well, where do they come up with the 3 million figure? It's a flawed figure. I won't go into their logic behind it, which is incorrect. But if Israel accepted 3 million Palestinians in Israel proper, what would happen? In no time, the Jewish state would cease to exist, because the Palestinians, through procreation, just populate so much vastly faster than the Israelis. As it is, without the Lord's intervention and overruling, within 10 to 15 years, there will be more Palestinians between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, this is Israel proper, and the West Bank, than there will be Jews. Now, the Bush strategy is this. They want the Saudi plan as a starting basis. Then they'll turn around to the Israelis. They'll say, well, you know, we'll let you refuse to accept the Palestinian refugees if you agree to withdraw to the 67 borders. That's Bush's strategy. Now, here is Israel's unfortunate ploy in all of this, and this is on our handout on page 9. Evangelical support Israel drive, 100,000 churches and 1 million Christians. What's Reed's first name, John? Ralph Reed. Remember Ralph Reed? He headed the Christian Coalition. He's the one that got President Bush elected. He is the one that is at the head of this drive, working with Israel to get 100,000 evangelical churches in the United States involved in this drive, and over 1 million Christians. For what purpose? To galvanize the tens of millions of evangelical Christians, born-again Christians, to what? Donate tens of millions of dollars to Israel and its causes, and also to exert such political pressure on the United States government that the United States government will favor Israel in all of the problems and peace negotiations and whatever else they will be involved in. Just to show you how freely this money flows from the evangelicals, my dear friend Mayor Omert of Jerusalem, and I've had a long talk with him about the evangelicals. In the early part of June, he went to Texas for a prayer session on behalf of Jerusalem at an evangelical church. Over $400,000 were raised, just that one event, to give to Omert, Mayor Omert, for his Jerusalem Foundation. You know, we have a message that the biblical Zionists love, but unfortunately they also love the millions and millions and millions and tens of millions of dollars that are being donated by the born-again Christians, who have their own agenda. Why are they supporting Israel? Why are they financing whole plane loads of Russian Jews to fly from Israel, or rather from Russia to Israel, to make immigration into Israel? Why are they supporting the West Bank settlements? Well, they feel that, one, all of the Jews have to come from the land of the north before their concept of the Second Advent can take place. And two, they feel that Israel has to have certain extended borders before their concept of the Second Advent will take place. That's why they're financing all of this. But they have, of course, their hidden missionary and conversion agenda. And if you read, and perhaps you have read, if you wasted your time or took your time to read the current series on the Left Behind, Their concept of the seven-year tribulation is nothing more than a second Holocaust that will make the first Holocaust look sick. And yet, the biblical Zionists, the government of Israel, is willing to work together with these people for the sake of the tens of millions of dollars that they're receiving. And in my discussion with government leaders, what am I going to say? Don't take this money? You can't, you know. They're not going to listen to that anyway. So I say, okay, take it. They owe it to you. And actually, it might be a fulfillment of prophecy, you know. I bring out their biblical picture of the current regathering of the Jews is the Exodus from Egypt, as is brought out in Ezekiel 20. And what did the Jewish people do when they left Egypt? They spoiled the Egyptians. They asked for their wealth. So I said, maybe you're fulfilling prophecy from that extent. But don't feel the least bit ingratiated. They owe it to you. And be very leery of their missionary agenda and their secret agendas. However, deep down, I feel the biblical Zionists in Israel are playing with fire. Instead of forming an alliance with the evangelicals, they should be in a massive outreach program to the secular Israelis in Israel and to the secular and reform and conservative Jews in this country to convert them to biblical Zionism. And that's where their alliance should be. And this is, we could go into scriptures that show that the biblical Zionists in Israel should be reaching out to the secular Israelis and bringing them into a biblical concept of the work that is going on there. But this is where the outreach of the biblical Zionists should be. So I don't feel that the Lord is pleased with this alliance between the evangelicals and the biblical Zionists, these Jewish biblical Zionists. And in the peace process, because of this alliance, I say that Israel just might, they're not saying they will, they might suffer quite a setback in the peace process and be forced to give up more land than they would like to. And then also, in the next Israeli-Arab war, which we feel Israel will win, but then we feel will take place, I think Israel just might, as a chastening from the Lord, suffer heavy losses, although they will win this next Arab-Israel war. And we have on page 10 and 11 of our handout War Inevitable in one article, and then in that article it shows that despite Israel's invasion into Area A, which is Palestinian territory, and under Palestinian sovereignty, Jenin and Ramallah and elsewhere, and the devastation that Israel did exact in those areas, still almost 71% of the Palestinians polled believe that the state of Israel should be eliminated. Not that they should just move back to their 67 borders, but that the state of Israel should be eliminated. So with all of the incursions and destruction of the PA's authority, the Palestinian Authority, the people on the street, the Palestinians on the street, the common man is still in favor of the completed elimination of the Jewish state. So we feel for that reason war is inevitable. And then the following article appeared in the Jerusalem Post. I won't take time to read it, but the bold type highlights the reasons why this article feels that if there is a Palestinian state, which pushes for and even Sharon is for, that a future war is inevitable. Okay, now on page 7. No, it's not page 7. It's page 8 at the top. 5 million Jews in Russia. This is the observation of my dear friend Professor Brandover, who some of you have met. He is, to me, one of the greatest men of faith in Israel. He's a moral giant. He's a giant of faith in biblical Zionism. And is very appreciative of Israel's appointment with Destiny, and his organization is distributing it throughout the Jewish communities in Russia for us. But you know, the official statistics, well, first of all, 1 million Jews have left Russia already and immigrated to Israel since 1989. And the official statistics of the Jewish population in the former Soviet Union is at the most 700,000. Professor Brandover is, among many other things, is having a massive encyclopedia being produced that deals with the last 1,000 years of Jewish history in Russia. So he had his editorial organization in Moscow take a poll throughout the former Soviet republics to evaluate on the basis of Orthodox criteria of who is a Jew. You know that issue, which we won't go into. Just how many Jews are left in Russia, in the former Soviet Union, rather. And their conclusion is, and he's dead set on this, and I discussed it with him thoroughly, there are 5 million Jews left in Russia. There are 5.5 million Jews here in the United States. That's a lot of Jews. And we feel that a lot of them, I won't say how many, probably a majority of them, or maybe not even a majority, but a tremendous amount of them will yet immigrate to Israel. And we would like to use Zechariah, the 10th chapter, as one of the scriptures. Before we get to Zechariah 10, read it, we just want to refer that up until, say, about 1991, there has been what I refer to as a trickle immigration of Russian Jews to Israel, simply because the communist government forbid Jews to immigrate from Russia to Israel. So that you have in Ezekiel, the 3rd chapter, it speaks of one from a city, and one from a family, and two from a city. But then further out, unfortunately, I don't have the exact verses here. Further down in that very same chapter, it shows that there's a much greater regathering of the house of Judah and the house of Israel from the land of the north. Now, in Zephaniah 10, verse 10, verse 9 shows that they are scattered in the far countries, and the Lord will bring them again to Israel. And he says, I will bring them again out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, and place shall not be found for them. And verse 11, he shall pass through the sea with affliction, and the waves of the sea shall be smitten, and the deeps of the river shall dry up, and the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Israel shall pass away. There is going to be such an exodus from Assyria and Egypt, that Gilead, the land of Gilead, in your last page of the handout, Gilead is on the east bank, not the west bank of Israel. It is what is now the nation of Jordan, or part of the nation of Jordan. And there will also be from this exodus of Jews from Egypt and Assyria, they will fill the land of Gilead, and they will fill Lebanon. We feel it refers to southern Lebanon especially. And before this happens, the Lord is going to smite a sea and a river, and then the pride of the Assyrian will be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away. Remember Ezekiel 20, we won't take time to read it again because we've referred to it so many times, but it shows that the Lord is gathering the Jews out of the nation with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and a fury poured out, and he's bringing them into the wilderness of the people, and he's pleading with them face to face as he pleaded with their fathers in the wilderness of Egypt. Well, this is a reference to the Exodus, and that's the current picture of the modern regathering. Remember in the Exodus, there's always, when you have a deliverance, you're delivered from something into something. In the Exodus type, Israel, to be delivered from Egypt, had to cross the sea. The Lord had to smite the sea miraculously so they could cross. He also had to divide the river Jordan so they could be delivered into the promised land. Well, here, Zechariah 10:11 speaks in connection with this regathering from Assyria and Egypt, a smiting of a sea and a smiting of a river, which we feel are symbolic of the obstacles that have held the Jews in Assyria and in Egypt. We do not feel Assyria and Egypt are literal, because there's about 400 Jews, less than 400 Jews in Assyria, literal Assyria, which is Iraq. Literal Egypt, there's less than 400 Jews, so that means there's going to be less than 800 Jews that are going to fill the land of Gilead and fill the land of Lebanon. No. Assyria, we feel, represents Russia. 1 million have left Russia. 5 million are still there. What's Egypt? You say the world. Well, what world? The Christian world. Where in the Christian world do you have the most Jews? Right here in the United States, 5.5 million. By the way, in the war on terrorism, if things get a lot worse in this country, which the predictions are, we're going to experience much more severe terrorism, acts of violence, even with nuclear, not nuclear bombs, but nuclear chemicals in ordinary explosives will disperse this radiation far and wide. If the war on terrorism gets to the point that the United States economy goes down way, 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 way down, you will probably see a great rise of anti-Semitism. And I don't think we're going to have a second Holocaust in this country. I think the Jews in this country will see ahead of time the handwriting on the wall, which in Germany only a few of them recognized ahead of time, and they left. But I think there are going to be large numbers of Jews who will see the handwriting on the wall and make mass exodus for Israel. And we feel that Isaiah, without taking time to read it, Isaiah 11:14 is a future Israel-Arab war, and then verses 15 and 16 show a further smiting of a river and a sea, so that there's a highway in which the Jews from Assyria go to Israel, like as they left the land of Egypt in the days of old. Now, what is the Lord's view of Israel? How does the Lord view Israel? We know some brethren feel that the Lord isn't having anything to do with Israel. Actually, Israel is a part of the kingdoms of this world, and it has to be swept off the scene before the kingdom can be set up, and then Israel will come into prominence. But there are a number of scriptures that speak of Israel today, before the mediatorial kingdom is set up, where God addresses them as my people. And one of these instances is in Joel, the third chapter, verses 1 through 8, or rather 1 through 3. You know, in the book of Revelation, the reason for the Armageddon on Christendom is one of the basic reasons is they persecuted the saints, spiritual Israel. But in the Old Testament, the portrayal of the reason for the Battle of Armageddon is because they persecuted natural Israel. And we have this in Joel 3, verses 1 through 3. For behold, in those days, and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations, and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and plead with them, and here we are in the Armageddon scene, plead with them for my people, and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations, and parted my land. And the word parted in the Hebrew word could just as well be translated partition my land. And the UN 1947 partition was just one of the many partitions of the land promised to Israel, and the Balfour Declaration has been continually chopped down and chopped down and chopped down by the Gentile governments of Christendom, so that the Lord gathers all nations to Armageddon, to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, one to punish them for how they treated his people, the Jews, whom they scattered among the nations, and for parting or partitioning their land. Okay, now, a future war. And on our chart, on page 7, we have a future war listed about 8 lines down, and a number of scriptures are given. We will just refer to them verbally. That is, the contents, quote the contents verbally or paraphrase them. Isaiah 11:14, verse 11 of Isaiah 11 speaks of the second regathering at the end of the gospel age. The first regathering was after the 70 years desolation. And it speaks of a war that Israel will have with the Philistines on the west, which is on your map the Gaza Strip, which is on the Mediterranean coast in the southern part of Israel on the west. And then Israel has a battle with Moab, Ammon, and Edom on the east, which is on the east side of the Jordan River, not the west bank, in which the children of Ammon, Moab, and Edom obey Israel. It's a decisive victory. By the way, you say, well, Brother Ken, you keep talking about a future war. What do you think's been going on? Aren't they having a war? Yes, they're having a war, but it's just between Israel and the Palestinians. For Israel to get more land, the other Arab nations have to be involved in it. Jordan has to be involved in it. Syria has to be involved in it. Possibly Egypt will be involved in it. Possibly Iraq will be involved in it. But Damascus is spoken of as a ruinous heap as a result of that next war. Syria will be involved in it. So the next war that we're referring to is a war not between just Israel and the Palestinians, but Israel and other Arab nations, so that they get territory beyond their current boundaries. Whatever they lose in the peace process will be regained in this future war, as well as the complete East Bank and perhaps all of Jordan, southern Lebanon up to Zarephath, which is brought forth to our attention in Obadiah. Verses 18 through 20. And as we said, Syria, Damascus, the capital of Syria, will become a ruinous heap. Now in Zephaniah 2:3 gives us the time setting for that chapter. Seek meekness, seek righteousness, and it might be that you shall be hid in the day of God's wrath. This is the time of trouble at the end of the gospel age. Verses 4 through 7 speak of Israel in a battle with the Philistines and or the Palestinians, and with Israel defeats them. And then verses 8 through 11 speaks of a battle Israel will have with Ammon and Moab. And Ammon and Moab will be completely destroyed. Okay, now the just one word about Obadiah. We feel there are some very interesting verses that we lose sight of in Obadiah, because usually we figure Obadiah, which is what, the longest book of the Bible, one chapter, speaks of Edom's destruction, and we say, well, that's a nominal church. Well, this is true, but you know, my biggest problem with Obadiah is finding it after Amos. This is true up to verse 18, but notice how verse 18 starts out, and the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble. So now verse 18 turns to natural Israel. And just as the previous verses were the destruction of Edom or Esau, Mount Edom and Mount Esau is the spiritual nominal house, now verse 18 shows a war in which the house of Jacob, and the house of Jacob always refers to who? Natural Israel, will be involved with literal Esau and literal Edom. And then in the following verses that describes many territories that will be gained in that war. Unfortunately, the King James is very poor. Just drop out the italic prints altogether and you'll get a better idea. But the Jewish Publication Society Bible is excellent on verses 18 through 21 to show other details of territory that the Jews will get in this future war. All right, now, all her lovers shall forsake her. And I have a reference here to the chart on page 18. Oh, no, not, yeah, the chart. Okay, that gives the scriptures for us. I was looking at my handout. Lines 8 and 11. Line 8, Israel commits a great sin while her lovers forsake her. And then 11, lovers forget her, how perhaps by going for the spoil themselves. Okay, now there's a variety of ideas that someplace between now and the invasion of Gog, Israel's lovers, nations that are associated with Israel, supporting Israel, will forsake her. I have a problem with this scripture in Jeremiah 30:14. We won't take time to read it, but it speaks of Israel committing a grievous sin. At the time her lovers forsake her. What is this grievous sin Israel is committing at the time her lovers forsake her? Well, it can't be the crucifixion of Jesus, because that debt was settled by the double punishment. They have been punished for their sins. But there's some great sin that Israel is committing when her lovers forsake her. Now, you know how it is when you read through the Bible umpteen times, and then all of a sudden the verse just jumps out at you, and you go through the ceiling, you're so excited. Well, I was reading about 7 years ago, Ezekiel 39, for the umpteenth time. And after we, invading forces of Gog are destroyed, verse 25 and 26, "Therefore thus saith the Lord God, now I will bring again the captivity of Jacob, and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel, and will be jealous for my holy name." Verse 26, "After that they have borne their shame, and all their trespasses whereby they have trespassed against me, when they dwelt safely in their land, and none made them afraid." Here the Lord is saying that he chastens Israel in the invasion of Gog for the great trespasses they were committing. When? When they dwelt safely in their land and none made them afraid. Well, what do you think of when you read that? You think of Ezekiel 38, verse 11. The unwalled village scene. And thou shalt say, that is Gog, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages, and I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars or gates. Well, what great sin! What great trespasses is Israel committing when she's dwelling in unwalled villages? And remember, when her lovers forsake her, she's committing some grievous sin. Well, we feel after the next Israel-Arab war, the United States and the UN and the Western powers will accept the new boundaries. And that war cannot take place until the United States and the Western powers are involved in some other crisis. And it's a given, accepted by all world authorities, that even a giant power like the United States cannot be involved in two world crises at the same time. So for these boundaries to stick in the next Israel-Arab war, the United States and the Western powers will have to be involved in some other crisis, and it might well be the war on terrorism against Islamic fundamentalism. I'm not saying it is, it might be. But there has to be some distraction, so that Israel, or rather the United States and the UN, Western powers, will accept the new boundaries, but they'll say, that's enough. Enough is enough. We're going to demilitarize the whole Middle East. And you'll say, Israel never agreed to that. Well, no less a hawk than Prime Minister Shamir agreed to the United States fighting the battle against Iraq for Israel, when Iraq was sending Scud missiles over to Israel. Israel just sat back and said, okay, you go fight our war for us. We feel Israel, we don't have time to go into the many reasons why Israel will agree to it, but the proviso will be that you will guarantee our security. In Ezekiel 38, and we're running now, you had the invasion of Gog, the associates of Gog coming into Israel, and there's a second set of nations that you're well aware of in verse 13, Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish, and they seemingly are down in Israel already. And they say, are you come to take a spoil? They're there. Are you come to take a spoil? We feel these represent the Western commercial powers, the Western capitalistic powers, but who will be the Western powers to guarantee Israel's boundaries at that time? We feel the churches will have come to power. It will be Christendom. The church-state systems of Christendom who will guarantee to Israel after the next Israeli-Arab war that they will give her secure boundaries. What is the great sin Israel commits when she's dwelling in unwalled villages? We suggest, and this is only a suggestion, putting facts together, but not a complete thus saith the Lord, scriptural facts together. Israel will entrust her security to Babylon, who is an abomination in the Lord's sight. And this will be, we suggest, the great sin that Israel will commit when she is dwelling in unwalled villages. guaranteeing, having her security guaranteed by Babylon. We feel the earthquake of Revelation 16 will have begun. When the invasion of Gog takes place, Russia will say, oh boy, this is our chance to take Western Europe. They're in throes of revolution. And they start heading for Western Europe, and the Lord puts a hook in their mouth and says, oh no, you're going down to Palestine to take a spoil there to finance your future wars and whatnot. And when they come to Palestine, the military forces that are guaranteeing Israel's boundaries will be there. The Western powers, symbolized by Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish in verse 13. And they will see the forces of God coming to take the spoil, which we feel is an economic prize. They come for other reasons. One, to take a spoil, to take a prey, that is just vengeance to destroy Israel. Three, to get back at the people that left them, the Russian Jews, the brain drain. There's a number of reasons given in verse 12 for this invasion. Taking the spoil is just one. So we feel that taking the spoil is the economic gain they will get. And we happen to feel that the mineral wealth of the Dead Sea, which hasn't been exploited yet because they don't have the power energy to carry out the electrolysis process, is the greatest concentration of mineral wealth in the world. When the Western powers station their troops stationed in Israel, securing Israel's borders, see God come down to take the spoil, they'll say, forget Israel. We're going to take the spoil ourselves. Our home governments are in revolution now. We need this military wealth. We need this economic wealth to recoup our home governments that are now in the throes of revolution, which is actually the earthquake of Revelation 16. Well, we'll end the story there. Not that we couldn't go on. And whenever I give a talk on prophecy, I try not to take myself too seriously. I feel very convicted, as you have heard. But if it doesn't happen that way, it's going to be better. The Lord bless you. Bow in your presence, so full of faith that you are present with us. We bow with hearts full of thanksgiving for the gift of Jesus, for your word of truth that gives us sense of direction, for your word of prophecy that enables us to stand in this evil day, and to lift up our hearts and rejoice, for we know that our deliverance draweth near. We pray for all of our brethren throughout the world. We leave them in your tender, loving care. We thank you for the love of this home ecclesia that has made this convention possible. We ask your blessing upon the meal that we're about to partake of as we break bread together. Let our fellowship redound to your name's honor and glory, for we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.